this evening, you're in for a treat because we have Dr. Darrell Bach, who is a professor at the Dallas Theological Seminary, obviously, right here in Dallas. He holds a bachelor's degree from the University of Texas.
You have talked to David, right?
And a master's in theology from DTS. Okay, and then PhD from the University of Aberdeen, and I don't think that's
not Aberdeen in the U.S. I don't.
No, it's in Scotland.
Oh, okay.
One in Scotland. That's what I thought. He's earned international recognition as a Humboldt Scholar
at some university in Germany.
Tübingen.
Thank you.
We practiced this before. I grew up learning, I was taught Texas English, and multi-syllable words sometimes can be a problem. And also he's known for his work in the Luke, Acts, and in Jesus' examination before the Jews. So there's more information about Dr. Bach on the website. Also you can visit the DTS website as well. But without further ado, Dr. Bach.
It's a real pleasure to be here this evening. Let me begin with a disclaimer, which is a terrible thing to do, but I'm going to do that because this is postmodernism, and so I can go wherever I want, however I want. I'm not a technical philosopher. I don't pretend to be. But what I hope to bring to this is a discussion of postmodernism as it tends to show up in the humanities in general. I do work with history a lot. Work with historiography, I work with hermeneutics a lot, and so that's where my interaction with postmodernism tends to come, is in those two areas. So I will deal a little bit with that.
Let me just say this about postmodernism. Before I define it, I want to talk about how you can react to it. First you deal with what the prescriptions might be, and then you present the disease. Anyway, some people's reaction to postmodernism is like an ostrich. Okay, you just put your head in the sand and hope that it goes away. Probably not going to happen. Second approach to it is a boogeyman. Okay, just treat it like the devil to be avoided. Third way to treat it is like a best buddy. Okay, you're welcome it. You put your arms around it. You're really glad to be around postmodernism. And then the fourth way, and this is really what I'm going to try and present tonight, is to treat it as a dialogue partner. It's a movement to be reflected on and to be critically engaged. And that's what I hope to do this evening. Two works from the early part of this decade that discuss postmodernism more from a sociological point of view. As I said, I work in history, and history and sociology tend to be my interests. And so I tend to read things from that angle more than technical philosophy. But the book is called Cosmopolis, and it's by Stephen Toulmin, who teaches at Northwestern University. And it's just a good analysis of how postmodernism has come into our culture and what drove it at a cultural level. And then Morris Berman, and from this title you might get a sense of what he thinks about it, The Twilight of American Culture, okay, is another work that deals with postmodernism. I tend to run into postmodernism because I teach in theology. I'm not a systematic theologian, which tends to be more philosophical. I'm a biblical studies person who tends to work more with history. But we come across it in our theological interaction all the time. And in our world, generally speaking, postmodernism tends to be viewed negatively. But as you're going to see tonight, I'm going to argue that there are both positives and negatives that come out of it. So with that as kind of an overview, probably the first thing to do is we ought to define this, and I'm going to give you two shots at a definition. One is going to come from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, which you got online, and the second is going to come from PBS, because all good things go through PBS. So the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy defines postmodernism this way. In the beginning, it's not encouraging. That postmodernism is indefinable is a truism, okay? That's not the best place to start trying to define something. You can't define it. However, it can be described as a set of critical, strategic, and rhetorical practices employing concepts such as difference, or probably difference is probably the way that would be pronounced coming out of French philosophy, repetition, the trace, Simulacrum, a word I just encountered in this definition for the first time, which basically means a copy or an image without an original. And then hyperreality, that's a sign with no relation to reality. Postmodernism's goal is to destabilize or deconstruct other concepts such as presence, identity, historical progress, and epistemic certainty, the leading of foundations, if you want to think of it that way, and the univocity, I guess, of meaning. The term postmodernism first entered the philosophical lexicon in 1979, so it's a relatively young term. In fact, it looks like everyone in this room is older than postmodernism, which means we were all born in the modern era, I guess. And with the publication of The Postmodern Condition by Jean-Francois Lyotard. So that's the definition according to the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. So that's kind of technical. So I said, well, let's put it in everyday English. So let's go to PBS. I figured if public broadcasting couldn't do it, then no one could. Postmodernism is largely a reaction to the assumed certainty of scientific or objective efforts to explain reality. In essence, it stems from a recognition that reality is not simply mirrored in human understanding of it, but rather is constructed as the mind tries to understand its own particular and personal reality. And one of the things that we're going to see is that postmodernism doesn't think there's anything like an I above or truth from above or anything, don't think of T with a truth with a capital T, anything like that. It is constructed. It views everything as constructed by the human mind and assembled by the human mind, but whether it actually corresponds to anything out there, whether there's anything out there for it to correspond to, that's a discussion they'll get into with you and hope to get you lost in. For this reason, postmodernism is highly skeptical of explanations which claim to be valid for all groups, cultures, traditions, or races, and instead focuses on the relative truths of each person. In the postmodern understanding, interpretation is everything. Reality only comes into being through our interpretations of what the world means to us individually. That may be a little bit oversimplified because I'm going to highlight a corporate dimension of postmodernism that this definition doesn't suggest. But the point about the assembling of perception into explanation is and the varieties that postmodernism offers of that is certainly a hallmark of postmodernism. Postmodernism relies on concrete experience over abstract principles, knowing always that the outcome of one's own experience will necessarily be fallible and relative rather than certain and universal. And so it's a way of relativizing our existence based upon the limitations of human understanding and the fact that no one walks around, you know, as an infallible being. So with that as the background of postmodernism, I'm not sure what the best way to do this is. If I just talk straight, or if you want to stop me as we go, question and answer set in? Okay, and I'll just go. I'm on automatic pilot. Okay. So here we go. Here's some more takes on postmodernism. And what I want to do is give you a feel for postmodernism. I think that's the best way to say it rather than a technical explanation, although those two definitions get us started. Postmodern refers to a culture emerging from and moving beyond modernism. It really is a reaction to the more certain ways of expressing things that modernism tends to reflect, and of course modernism's roots go back into the Enlightenment. Even reacting against it, it especially is a different way of seeing, talking, and prioritizing the elements we use to process and understand life. And it also is about values, and you're going to hear that as I talk about it. It is a very mixed bag with things to teach us and things we need to be skeptical about, as postmodernism is about other things. So I'm going to be postmodernist about postmodernism. In other words, it best functions as part of a dialectic and not as an autonomous lens. Ironically, in saying this as a critique of postmodernism, we honor the lack of certitude postmodernism wishes to foster. So I'm having a little fun here with postmoderns. And if they don't like it, that's okay, because you're not supposed to like what a postmodern says. All right, themes in postmodernism. Themes are shifts of movement. Well, now, again, I'm going to work with metaphors here. One of the things postmodernism likes to do is rather than deal in propositions, and statements of truth. They like to deal in stories and pictures and images and that kind of thing. So work with metaphors. One of the metaphors that they don't like is the idea of conquest or victory, control or progress, so that nothing's left to conquer. And conquest is seen as part of the problem, as there's nothing left to conquest. So they move from conquest to emphases on conservation. So we might describe the move this way, from movements rooted in power and control to movements that try and work for preservation, if I can picture it that way. Not commenting yet positively or negatively, just being descriptive. I already noticed that mentioned the second one. For propositions to stories, learning takes place through implicit teaching, but often looking for the gaps and problems in a story as well that destabilizes narrative. So it isn't just working through a narrative to see the story that someone is telling, but it's also analyzing that narrative for the inconsistencies in the story and the way in which the story doesn't hold together. Could create a kind of schizophrenia if you try and follow the narrative line on the one level, but you're attacking the narrative line on the other. It reacts to authority. Like scripture in theology or institutional authority, wherever that might be, in government or whatever. From authority to a kind of harmony between authority, between authority, they recognize that there are power structures, but in the personal ways, God mysteriously speaks to people. Now, I frame this one theologically. This is one of the few points that I've left kind of in the realm of theology. But in theology, of course, what we often have is we work with scripture or we work with an institutional church, which kind of sets the ground rules. But you can see in the emphasis towards the personal way God mysteriously speaks to people, you get this movement to the individualized independence, if I can think of it that way, that postmodernism, the definition of postmodernism that we saw PBS give us, is also highlighting this individual framing of reality. Again in theology, from a theology aimed at preparing for death to preparing a theology for life. So the emphasis is not on things like, you know, how do you avoid going to the very warm place at the end of life and things like that, but instead talking about how should we live and what does that look like. Now, here's one where I'm going against the PBS definition. I already hinted at this. Postmodernism works or tends to work away from merely individual perspectives to a corporate emphasis. Now, you're going to see this kind of takes two tracks. And what I mean by that is, it isn't just our individual perception that matters to postmoderns, but postmoderns have a deep commitment to kinds of community, but that community can manifest itself in one of two ways. It can cluster like-minded people who take the same perspective on things and become, if we were formally in philosophy, we might think of the philosophical schools that one might gravitate towards, that kind of thing. And so like-minded people hang out together and take their stand with their perspective, declare what their perspective is and launch ahead. That's one kind of corporateness. Or the other kind of corporateness might be a broader perspective that basically says, there's value in a lot of voices. It can go in one of those two ways. In fact, postmodernism in Europe and some forms of postmodernism in the United States are very different. This will show up in hermeneutics. I'm going to talk about that a little later. And it's this kind of a difference that helps to produce that. From sectarian or singular perspective to greater acceptance and curiosity about other ways to know. Since understanding is so perspectival, if I can use that word, if it's so framed by individualized impressions of what goes on as a way of attempting to describe reality, then the more variety of perspectives I get, theoretically, the more beneficial that can potentially be. Again, speaking in spiritual terms, but not necessarily strictly theologically, from passive to active spiritual journey, and again I'm going to use the metaphor of a picture of a church, instead of a church as a place where people take up space in a pew, the emphasis is on being a mission outpost that sends people out. How can I actually serve? What does service actually look like, as opposed to simply coming in and collecting knowledge? Another way to kind of say the same thing is from from an intellectual engagement, and maybe engagement's too soft a word here, even intellectual conflict over ideas and doctrine, to an emphasis on experience, from arguing about faith to talking about the dance of faith. Okay? Different kind of description. I said I prepared out all the theology of this, but actually it's not true as I'm going through these points. I'm seeing all kinds of things. But anyway, from salvation as event, a decision of faith or a conversion moment, to emphasizing the journey of salvation, or salvation as a process that drives one's entire life. So rather than, say, walking an aisle and viewing that as kind of the moment, then it has to do with going through a door and entering into an experience, a spiritual experience. Again, from salvation of humanity alone to salvation of all creation. So you see an emphasis on stewardship even into the creation oftentimes out of a postmodern perspective and set of concerns. From motivating through fear, and again, hell being a good metaphor here for motivation out of fear, to motivating through compassion, community, and hope, an invitation into life. And then 12 is like 8, and I couldn't decide whether to pair it or to just repeat it and try and say what I'm talking about, but from dogmatic truth or doctrine to a search for spiritual experience, where the issue is not trying to figure out how to articulate what I'm going through so much as a matter of doctrine, as it is to sense and develop and appreciate the kind of experience that I'm walking through as I journey through life. So postmodernism often, in fact almost always, is shed of any sense of absolutes because there is no I from above. And there's a sense of what is common between religions versus talking about what is distinct. And I'll come back to this one later because religions do have certain things that are in common that we're trying to encourage people to do, but there also are distinct emphases in religion that create some of the differences that also are a part of that conversation. So that's the descriptive part of what I'm going to do. I'm not going to take anywhere near an hour, by the way, so we'll have plenty of time for questions. Okay, some more metaphors to work with. Again, trying to be descriptive, is one of the things that postmodernism is very skeptical of, and it's reacting against in the modern world, is a kind of consumerism or materialism. And so it views the consumerist world as kind of having consumerism serves as a kind of unhealthy drive for culture. It roots culture in the trivial or in that which really doesn't last. It's rooted oftentimes, consumerism, as postmodernists will see it, is rooted in competition and dividing, that kind of thing. And so it's pretty negative about the whole way much of the modern world has structured life. It also represents a shift in that has come alongside what has happened to our world in terms of processing information. We have gone from a world that highlights print literacy and literal and linear thinking, by which I mean when I teach, for example, the idea of working through an outline in order to present something that has some sense of logic and connectedness to it as you go from one idea to the next and try and put the whole thing together, to working with pictures, stories, and what we might call layered thinking, or what we might call linked thinking, and spontaneous linked thinking. So this is outlines versus the net and web pages. I'm going to work on this one a little bit and just hang with me here. You know, when I went to school and we were taught how to write an essay, you know, you were taught how to outline, how to think through logically, how to develop, and, you know, there were a variety of ways to outline, but the idea was you're going to take the reader from A to B, there's going to be a logical sequence of how things connect, and the reader's going to move through it with you as you try and present your thesis or whatever it is that you're doing as you're making your logical argument. Well, people don't interact with information. Kids don't interact with information that way anymore, for the most part. They go to a web page. Well, when you go to a web page, what you're presented with is a web page, and most web pages I have seen do not have outlines. Okay? Maybe a few of them do, but if they do, they're designed by someone who doesn't understand how a web page is structured. Okay? Most web pages have an entry, and they'll have lots of places to click, and they'll have a sidebar that has other places to click. And
There's nothing that tells you you've got to start at the top of the page and work your way down through each of the clicks down to the bottom. Nor is there anything that says in the sidebar you've got to start at the top of the page and work your way systematically through. You can go wherever you want, whenever you want. And you can start at the bottom of the page. You can start at the side of the page. You can go from the side of the page over to the bottom of the page. There's no rhyme or reason to the sequencing that you give to the information that appears on a web page. And so this is a very different way of processing information. I like to tell two stories about information in our world and how it gets processed today. One of them is the story of what happens on a news channel today. If you go to a news channel today and you think about what all is happening, you've got your scroll line down at the bottom of the page, and it's giving you just one set of constant information. Usually, you have not just one talking head, but a couple of talking heads. You might have them in two or three, four boxes. They might launch in at any point in time. In fact, if you do media, the media people will tell you, go ahead and interrupt, go ahead and be rude. That makes for better TV. And I know this because I've done these shows, and I tend to be polite. And so they tend to tell me not to be polite, and I can't get the politeness out of me, so it's just very hard to do. But anyway, and so there are a lot of things going on TV. I remember the transition as we moved from kind of the basic news talking head who just came and presented the news. They still basically do this in Europe. You get the guy on, the most activity you'll get on the screen on a lot of news channels in Europe is you get the guy talking, you might get a picture in the background. Two things to take care of. That's not too tough. But if you go to a news channel today in the States, oftentimes you got four or five or six different places you can go for information. There's so much happening all at once. And for my wife and I, as we moved through this transition, the screen became too busy. It just became too busy to keep your eye on everything. It was frustrating. But to my kids, who've grown up with it all their life, it doesn't bother them at all. It's what they're used to. It's how they process information. Another example, the same kind of thing, a story I love to tell, is when my middle daughter, who at the time was, this was just a few years ago, got married, and we were in Nashville. She lives in Nashville. And we went to a furniture store to help them buy some furniture for their first home. And we're in the furniture store, and my wife is an interior decorator by training, although she's a paralegal. I guess that speaks to what happens when you train to be an interior decorator. But anyway, she's a paralegal, but she's an interior designer by trade, so my daughter took my wife with me to the furniture store. Well, I'm useless when it comes to furniture. I mean, all I need to know is if I sit on it, will it hold me up, and that's, I don't care how it looks as long as it works. So I don't know if that's postmodern or not. Anyway, and so we're in the furniture store, and they're off looking at some furniture. I think it was a dining room table, if I remember correctly. And I'm watching MTV on the screen, which is what they had on in the furniture store. And I'm counting. I'm counting how long an image is on the screen. And the count went like this. One, one, two. One, one, two. One, two. One, two, three. One. One, two. And as I started to do this, and I started to look at my watch to see how long it would take me to get to four. And I did this for about 3 minutes and never got to four. And so I called my wife over. And I said, I'm going to do this for you because this is interesting. This has been going on for a while now, and I just want to count. And again, started counting. And again, for a couple, 3 minutes, and I never get to the number four. These images are coming one after some of the time. You didn't even make it to one, And these images just keep coming one after another, and something's going on. And I turned to my wife, and I said, that's how kids process information today. In microbursts, as opposed to in sustained presentation. And I said, I'm not making a comment about whether it's good or bad. I'm just saying it's a different way of processing what is coming at you. And when you're trained to do it, and my kids are trained to do it, they do it by instinct. When they're trained to do it, that's one thing, but when you have to transition from one kind of way of processing information to another, that's a little harder to move because you're used to something else. And it actually happened within the generation of my kids. My oldest daughter, who is just about to turn 30, and my middle daughter, who's just a year and a half behind her, still read books.
They love to read. You know, we had a house that had books all around. I have, you know, a huge library. I've got a study with, you know, several thousand volumes in the house. I mean, I read all the time. And they were used to that. My youngest son, my three kids, the youngest is a son, he's turning 25. He's actually in law school right now, so he's having to read all the time. But he does not like to read, and his instinct in going for information is different than my daughter's. My daughters will go to a book or go to the computer. They can do either. But if you give them a problem, they're just as likely to go up to a book on a shelf as they are to use their computer to find information. My son will go through the computer automatically first without blinking. And the way I know this is one day I was working on a book and I was getting ready to look something up. I couldn't find it, and I started to get up and I was talking to my son about it. And I started to get up to go to my library to go get the book. He said, "Dad, you don't have to get up." I said, "What do you mean? You don't have to get up?" He typed on his computer. He was sitting next to me, typed on his computer. "Here it is." Okay? He knew exactly what I needed. He knew exactly how to go get it. The information that he got was very good. It was exactly what I was looking for. It was what I needed, you know, and he got it. So my point, I may spend a long time on this because this is important. I think this is one of the ways our culture is changing. This is one of the ways that the generations process material differently today, the younger group, than we do. It produces all kinds of expectations, I think, in terms of how we deal with information, that kind of thing. We have moved from a print literacy and literal thinking to pictures and stories and layered thinking. And I see it in my students that I teach. They instinctively process information differently and have different expectations about how to process information and how to present information than I do. And I've been teaching for 30 years. You know, so I'm used to processing and presenting information, but they do it very differently than I do, just instinctively, because of the context in which they have grown up. And it's changing more rapidly all the time. Another different metaphor is that, now this depends. I put it up here, and I debated whether to put it up here, but what I'm trying to suggest here, at least one strand of postmodernism, tends to move from nationalistic concerns to global concerns if the postmodernism doesn't go tribal. And what I mean by that is, if it doesn't say, everybody has their own perspective, this is the perspective I choose to come from, and this is the perspective I am holding to. Okay? Again, put it in church context, it's not mega church. You know, we don't like to walk into the church where we got thousands of people and we're surrounded by thousands of people we don't know, but rather a community and cell or small group oriented. Generally speaking, they favor the less centralized and more localized forms of community expression. And again, depending on whether that goes tribal or not, can indicate the kind of postmodernism you're dealing with. It's a world and array of perspectives, not a world of absolutes. It's a world and array of probabilities and not certainties. So you're forced to make judgments all the time. That's the emphasis. If this is the key, if you're even interested in trying to make judgments. Some forms of postmodernism don't say, don't make judgments at all. Just live in the midst of the probabilities. And so this also expresses itself in knowledge as relational versus abstract propositions. So again, I didn't express this theologically. It's obeying Scripture and seeing its diversity and embracing its diversity versus knowing scriptural teaching and seeking its harmony. That's the difference between it being relational emphasis versus abstract propositions and moving into dogmatics and theology and that kind of thing. So, those are the different metaphors. Okay, now I promised you in talking about this that I would talk about positives and negatives. So I'm taking off my descriptive persona now, and now I'm putting on my evaluative persona, which if I'm a true postmodern, I ought not to do. Okay? I ought to just leave it in the description and leave you to sort it out. Okay? But there's enough modernists in me, and I'm old enough, that I still have an opinion every now and then. So I'm going to share it. So here we go. The clear strength is that there is a problem with modernity in its spirit of freedom and quest for human autonomy. One of the things that postmodernism attacks that moves it in a more corporate direction is it doesn't like the individual spirit of freedom that was so prominent in the development of the Enlightenment. Now remember, the Enlightenment is reacting to kind of things like ecclesiastical authority and that kind of thing, which drove towards the individualism. This is a comeback to the corporate, but it's not going through the same door that you had before you got to the Enlightenment. So there's a problem with modernity and its spirit of freedom and its quest for human autonomy. And if I can use an analogy, and this shouldn't be hard for anyone in Dallas, it's like everyone getting on the Central Expressway and doing their own thing and not caring about the rules of driving. Okay? That's what they're reacting against. If everyone is a complete independent spirit, then the only thing they care about is what they do independently, it's like a bunch of cars trying to drive by their own rules on a road. And that's a mess. Postmoderns do not like this kind of highly individualized autonomy, even in the midst of recognizing or arguing that perceptions are largely individualized, okay, in terms of how we perceive things. But I think that's a strength because I think it keeps us from being so individually focused that we don't care about the corporate units that we circulate in, which are obviously important for society to function. The problem with modernity, I think I'm articulating this as a strength, the problem with modernity is the dominance of the consumer culture and the way it can lead to a compromise of values in order to advance in terms of being a consumer, and the abuse of people as objects. Okay? So it reacts to a kind of materialism that leads to the treatment of people as objects or the devaluing of people in the process. The problem with modernity, you see, there's all stated as reactions to modernity. The problem with modernity is that efficiency and technology can depersonalize or overwhelm life. There was a book written in the 90s. The title alone is worth the book. It was called The Sociological Study of Modern Culture, and the title of the book was called The Saturated Self. And the image was how modern culture keeps throwing so much at us from so many directions. We're having to process so much that you're a little bit, if I can use a biblical figure and abuse it a little bit, you're a little bit like a stuffed wineskin, okay? And you know, you get stuffed enough, okay, the wineskin bursts, okay, and then the wineskin's useless. And so the picture of modern culture constantly coming at us in such a way that we're the saturated self. And when we accept modernity and its goals and its values, the postmodernist claims, what happens is that we get overwhelmed by the culture. We get overwhelmed by what's happening to us. Versus the emphasis and the value that postmoderns tend to highlight, which is the nurtured self tied to a community. Now notice, this isn't the nurtured self operating in an island, okay? But this is the nurtured self tied to a community. And again, depending on whether that community is self-focused or whether it's broad, will determine the nature of the community experience that's being espoused. More strengths, all shorter. Interpretation is never totally objective. We all read from a place and a perspective. Okay, that's something that postmodernism highlights and is true to a degree. I'm going to come back to this one. Communities matter, and so do corporate perspectives. We certainly have learned this. The more our world gets, people say the bigger our world gets, the smaller it gets simultaneously. Because even though we're more globalized and it's big and there are more people, we're more connected and we're more aware of what's going on with more groups all the time. So our world's both bigger and smaller simultaneously. So communities matter, and so do corporate perspectives in thinking through things. Differing perspectives can teach. I think that's a strength. The emphasis on the lack of objectivity, or at least the limitations of the interpreter, means that the postmodern appreciates an interpreter's limits in dealing with texts and ideas. No person is infallible. Interpretations need testing, and so it emphasizes a plea for a proper humility. There's a push for authenticity. Again, not what the culture says I should look like, not what the culture, tries to paint me into be, but being who I really am and appreciating that and living that way. It recognizes our social location, where we fit in the world, and how that helps sometimes, and also can sometimes blind us our particular location can keep us from seeing certain things that we might see more instinctively. Anyone who's traveled internationally understands this blindness thing. I take students down to Guatemala periodically for a class on cross-cultural hermeneutics, where we take our students usually out of a very comfortable Western environment. We drop them right in the middle of a majority world country, what I like to call the two-thirds world, to remind people it's not the third world as if it's a minority. It's somewhere the way most of the world functions. And so you drop them in the middle of this, and the school, the seminary where I teach at in Guatemala is literally four blocks from the garbage dump in Guatemala City. World Vision has an orphanage that operates on the edge of the garbage dump that works with children who are literally being raised in the garbage dump of Guatemala City. They've never seen poverty like this. We ask them, they have one assignment when they go down. The assignment is, how would you read the Bible differently living here than you do where you live in the West? In the States. We're still in the West, but still in the States. And of course, what they immediately begin to see are all the passages in the Bible that deal with the poor and justice and those kinds of themes that they tend not to see when they're in the West, because they're now synthesized to it. They can smell it. Okay? You can smell poverty in Guatemala. Okay? Probing links back to tradition. Another thing that this corporate emphasis can engender, it doesn't always do so, but can engender, is a desire to be in contact with perspectives across history. Okay? So that can reconnect you back to tradition in ways in which autonomy and freedom tends not to connect us. Okay? Because I'm just, it's my world, and I construct it, and I'm independent, so I've got to do it on my own, that kind of thing. Its sense of community can push for a sense of history within movements. And so one of the things that you see, and again, I'm speaking out of my own sociological world, one of the things that we're seeing in theological circles is younger people who tend to come to the church are interested in the history of the church going all the way back. They don't just want to know how it's done in the 21st century. They're asking questions like, how do they do it in the 1st century, and in the 4th century, and in the 6th century? They want to have a sense of connection to the rest of history. I think it may have to do that modern society makes us feel a little bit rootless. Okay? So they're looking for roots. And another thing postmodernism tends to do is it tends to have better success with people on the edge, because it tends to be sensitive to where they may be coming from. So those are some strengths of postmodernism. Now some problems. What can happen in postmodernism, and often does, is that it claims a perspective without introspection. In other words, it says, everyone has a view, everyone has a bias, so I'm just going to name my bias and go for it. Okay, and in that process, a point of view is simply affirmed, the perspective that I have, and it's not pursued to be validated, it's simply adopted. And so this can lead to social forms of tribalism, and I can say this whether we're talking about people politically on the left or the right. It can manifest itself on either edge of the spectrum, because it has to do with the fundamental approach in terms of how you process the variety of perspectives you're coming across. I'm just going to adopt one, and that's the way I'm going to live. Another problem is that I think sometimes it can be accused of oversimplifying modernism, that modernism may be more diverse in expression than is suggested by the kinds of absolutist contrasts you sometimes see postmodernism make about the modern world. The modern world is very complex. It always has been, and it's had a lot of levels to it. Granted, there might be a thrust and emphasis to modernism that dominates, and most of modernism's criticisms of modernism deal with the more powerful expressions of modernism that have formed our culture. But modernism has some pockets of things that are worth reflecting on. Some of the writing by a sociologist named Neil Postman, and he's dealing with this transition to a more technological world, and is lamenting what we lose when we leave the world of sequential literacy, if I can say it that way. The world of the outline, of organizing your thoughts, that kind of thing. He teaches at New York University. There is a seeming devaluation of assessment and discernment in moving towards resolution. We just have to live with this variety, okay? And let's not make judgments about it. It's there, and we just have to live with it. Okay, so you kind of live with the chaos. The angle of vision is more important than what is seen or making a judgment about it. So we stop with the recognition that there are perspectives, but we don't do anything to try and work and resolve whether some of those perspectives are necessarily more healthy for us or not. There's a stepping back from the area of assessment, as complex as that is for finite human beings. There's too much either-or thinking or either-or rhetoric rather than thinking in both and modes. Even in postmodernism, you get this. Even though there's a lot of talk about a variety of perspectives or whatever, when this tends to manifest itself, it tends to manifest itself still in contrasts. There's too much seeking of disjunction, inconsistency, and discontinuity in what's around us and in evaluating what's around us. It's the kind of the skeptic on steroids. Versus pursuing a sense of unity and complementarity. How can we take what's out there and the variety of what's out there and make some sense out of it? If I can, I will try this. Okay, this may be a dangerous metaphor to use. But I think in our world today, we've lost our ability to have good, healthy social discourse. We have become a community, talk about America, we have become a community that is driven by ideologies. Driven by ideologies on the left and on the right, simultaneously. And we're working with the edges, and everyone is tested against how faithful they are to the ideology either on the right or the left, and there's very little room for anyone in the middle. So what happens in our election, our poll? I just wrote a piece for Dallas Morning News on this last week in response to a Texas faith question. And what's happened is that the center, there's little or no center in our society. But what happens in our elections is the center is large enough, neither end is large enough control politics in the states. And the center happens to be just large enough to be able to swing. So what happens in our elections? We swing. The center pulls one way, and one group sides with one group, and then lo and behold, they don't like what happens, so they swing back, and we go through these lurches. And the reason we're going through these lurches is because what's controlling our political discourse is not a dialogue and an engagement, but an entrenchment of each end going after each other. And you see it on the way the media handles the issues. We even have networks formed around these ideologies, you know, to drive the point home. I don't think it's healthy for our culture or for our society. And this kind of adopting your perspective and just digging in and looking for the disjunctions on the other side and learning how to analyze how someone else doesn't have it right, meanwhile you've got it perfectly together, works at and destroys any sense of unity or complementarity that you can work towards if you're not careful. It tends to avoid areas, now this is going to sound contradictory to what I've just said, but it tends to avoid discussion of areas of confrontation, by which I mean, once you've adopted the perspective and you've taken on a postmodern mindset, unless you just step back completely and you tend to view it from your angle, the only confrontation you'll engage in is confrontation not of yourself in the way you think, okay, but of the way someone else thinks. So you often take sides without any validation except for the preference from experience, except where perhaps it might confront tradition. And postmodernists love to say, we're postmoderns, we don't like modernism. So we'll confront modernism wherever we see it, okay, but don't ask us to take on ourselves. Then the last category, I think this is the last one on the slides, and with this I'll be done, tends to equivocate on moral issues since no view from above exists. And so it relativizes human experience into a world of nothing but moral ambiguity. Now this actually leaves us, in certain situations, in a pretty terrible position. Okay, I actually have one more slide. And that is, in places where there is a lot morally at stake, for example, in the use of violence in our world and that kind of thing, the use of violence that ends up abusing human beings, this manifests itself in a wide variety of ways. If there's no inherent morality to drive how you evaluate that, that every perspective has its own right to exist and has its own right to function in the direction that it lays out for itself. So how do you make moral judgments? Now, in a fairly civilized world, that may or may not be so painful. But in a world that isn't always civilized, and we've seen that in the last 10 years, the world that's not always civilized, that's a very dangerous place to be. Okay, some applications real quickly. I'm trying to keep this to the time. I see this in history. I see history sometimes saying, it's some historians saying, well, all history is constructed. Or another variation that's very common in the humanities and history. History is written by the winners. Okay, so you only get history from a certain angle. And so we need the variety of perspectives to kind of break that down. And there's some truth to that. But the danger on the other side is, if all you have is the, how am I going to say this, the cacophony of perspectives, okay, if that's all you have, then you can't step in and deal with some very painful realities in our history. Things like the Holocaust. How do you make judgments about the Holocaust? How do you make judgments about what to do in a place like the Middle East? And how do you have that conversation? And what should that history teach you? Those kinds of things. That's history. In interpretation, we need to appreciate that what tends to happen in postmodern interpretation is the reader counts for almost everything in interpretation. You don't really wrestle with what an author attempted to communicate by what they're writing, or what that text communicates by being put in a context. The reader is the key. Whenever you're dealing with interpretation, you're always dealing with three realities. You're dealing with the author, who you, unless you're in a modern situation, you can never see or meet. A text, which he produces, which is what you encounter, and then you as the reader trying to make sense out of that text. And what used to happen in classical forms of interpretation is that you tried to drive to get back to the author and what it was he was trying to say. What has happened in more modern forms of interpretation is that the whole issue becomes how the text impacts the reader. Okay, and you may or may not be concerned with trying to get back to what an author tried to say. Well, to me, when you read, you've got a variety of things going on. You read the text. You try to come to grips with what it is trying to say, it seems to me, first, and then you go out the process of interpreting what it is it's saying, making judgments about how it's coherent or not. And then you critique what it is the author presents. And I think those are three distinct steps of reading, if you want to think of them that way. But what has often happened today is that we've forgotten the reading and we don't wrestle with the interpretation. We really don't try and understand the author in his terms and in his world. We simply react to what it is that we read. And that's a danger, I think, in postmodern interpretation. Now, I like the image that Gadamer gives us of what he calls the fusion of horizons, where you've got a perspective that's coming at the text, and you've got your own perspective that you're reading it through. And these two things, I'm going to use, this is not his image, but I'm going to use it. These two things collide in a reading. Okay? The way he describes it is it's a fusion of horizons. You've got one person coming from another angle, another person, you've got the text coming from one angle, the reader coming from another angle, and there's a fusion of horizons. Understanding takes place when that text helps you see the world differently, and there's kind of a fusion that happens. I tell my students, the real test in reading is when you read something and you go, ooh, I didn't expect that. Now what do I do? And so I tend to like a model that does some assessment, that tries to understand the author first, interprets him, and then steps back and makes a critique. In philosophical assessment, what we're dealing with in postmodernism is a reaction, I'm going to come down to the bottom of the slide, is a reaction to what we call transcendental idealism on the one hand, or simple empiricism on the other. And what I prefer is what is called critical or transcendental realism. Transcendental realism says there's a real world to engage out there. Not everything is simply the summation of my way of the way I perceive it. There are certain things out there that are really out there, regardless of how I perceive them or not. Now, my understanding of them may be imperfect. That's fine. But there's something out there to engage. That's the realism part. But our ability to assess it is not exhausted. And so I have to be critical in the way I engage that reality. This is what critical realism, I think, is. So still we are to assess, not merely accept the world as constructed merely by human social context. There are things out there and assessments to be made. So I actually prefer a philosophical approach. We're going to talk about it in those kinds of terms, of what is called critical realism. Roy Bakhtiar is the name that is tied to this, among others. Bernard Lonergan is another name that's associated with theology in this area. And it's an attempt to argue, yes, we're limited. There are issues of perception. Yes, there's bias. But there's a dialectic that can take place in the conversation that's very important. And there's something out there to assess that we have to think about engaging. It's not merely what I perceive in my own head, nor is it a collection, merely a collection of what all our perceptions are, with each of those perceptions inherently collecting a kind of inherent equal value. Now, we're much better off interacting with each other, as we're about to do, and having a real conversation, a real dialectic, a real engagement. So, in sum, postmodernism, positives and negatives, of value to us in helping us think through where we've come from as people who came out of modernism, on the one hand, and shortcomings that reach back perhaps even into the Enlightenment, on the one hand, and yet on the other hand, some potential dangers that make assessing life perhaps more complicated, perhaps because it appreciates how complicated assessing life is, but that doesn't mean you give up. Because the easiest thing to do is to just say, well, it's all a mess and it's difficult and who can figure it out, so we'll just do the best we can. And so I've done the best I can, and I hope that's been helpful to you.
All right. Well, how about some questions? And please keep your commentary, if you will, to a minimum. Really, truly ask a question. And we do have a history of being pretty civilized.
That's good.
And I know the audience is going to continue to behave in that fashion. So, have our questions.
What has been the impact of postmodernism on law?
That's a good question, and I wish my son were here to answer this, because he's currently in law school, and my brother, my older brother, is a lawyer, and we have spent a lot of time talking about interpretation in my interaction with my older brother, who loves history as I do, and you know, the whole issue of interpreting law and whether the whole issue of original framing versus contextualizing law and the way the world changes, which can impact the way the law can and should be read. All these are discussions. Theology and law are like sisters, okay? And so I think what you are seeing in our world in the debate about it in legal interpretation is the problem of hermeneutics that I articulated. And that is, do you wrestle with trying to get it an original reading, and then if you really think through that original reading, do you even push for thinking through whether that reading should be critiqued or not because of the new context in which we find ourselves, or do you simply go strict constructionist? That's what it read, that was the intent, and that's the end of it. I think in law what we've seen, and this is the spirit of where this whole approach takes us, in fact modernism took us there as well, so I don't think this is particularly postmodern necessarily, is that it is created an appreciation for contextualization, and as a result has opened up the idea of things like judicial review and that kind of thing, where judges can be more activist in the way they read law, interpret law, interact with law. And I think the reality is that we have been in that mode, certainly in our history, if you take the Supreme Court as an example, since the Warren Court. And I'm not going to put a value judgment on that. I think that's where we are, and I actually think the modern world pushes us to some degree in that direction.
because the world that we live in now is not the world that we lived in when some of these laws were originally written. And that's part of the point of adding an element of judgment and reflection into how law gets handled, even though it's supposed to be precedent-based. So those are things that come into tension with one another, and that's why you get the kinds of legal debates that you do. I don't know if you want to follow up there.
No.
Okay.
We're good.
Yes.
A little two-pronged thing. I'd like to comment on a couple of hypothetical assertions. One of them, it just occurs to me that with a whole description of postmodernism, I find it hardly any different than just liberalism in general. I mean, it's a philosophy. You might say whatever you think about that, or if I'm missing some point. The other thing, though, there was a paper put out some years ago by a fairly liberal think tank involving the University of Chicago Divinity School, which is quite liberal, and
right.
The Institute of American Values. They put out a paper, and one of the conclusions that they came to after debating a lot, the conclusion in this paper said that if transcendent values do not exist, all that's left is power. And that seems to fit in
wrapping
some of the debate that you were getting
out. Yeah, let me go in reverse order, because I think the second comment is potentially very true. And I actually think that we operate in the world of power regardless of whether we have transcendent values or not, because some people apply their transcendent values and still operate in a way that can use and abuse power if we're not careful. I think a check on power is a kind of what I would regard as an intense respect for what it means for people to be, now I'm not going to be theological, being created in the image of God, and the respect that that should automatically give each human being who walks the earth. Which means that there's a check, that the presence of that sacredness, if I can say it that way, should operate as a kind of check on power and its use, and particularly its abuse. So that's my comment on your second thing. The first one is whether this is liberalism or not. It's liberalism in a sense. There's a part of me that wants to probe you and say, is liberal a good or a bad word for you when you make the statement? But I'll leave that. Often attempted to ask it.
I'm a centrist.
Uh-huh. What?
I'm a centrist.
You're a centrist? Okay, that's good. I think that what you see both in the Enlightenment and in postmodernism, what they share is a heavy skepticism towards what I might call the presence and claims of authority. The Enlightenment tends to express it through individual conscience. Postmodernists tend to deal with it by talking about the variety of perspectives that exist and that there's no I from above. There's no absolute to appeal to. But they're both trying to make a case that there is no right to dictate how people live. Okay, now if that's how you define liberalism, then I think the answer to your initial statement also is positive. That yes, this is a form of liberalism because it detaches any sense of responsibility to a kind of authority or an authority operating over people. It makes us autonomous, whether individually autonomous, Enlightenment, or corporately autonomous, postmodernism. Yes.
Two questions. First of all, his question, you said that theology or religion is a check on power.
No. Actually, that isn't what I said. Okay. What I said is it ought to be. Okay. That's a big difference. Okay. Okay.
That question goes away.
Okay.
Processing differently, when you have different contexts, as you say, my children see things different than my grandchildren see things different every 12 to 18 months.
Mm-hmm. Let them get older.
Technology and the
world that they are. Yeah, absolutely. It's happening so fast that You know, it's the difference between, another analogy, it's the difference between my kids who grew up, you know, who were working initially with things like AOL, and kids today who Facebook and Twitter and all that kind of stuff. And when you watch them Facebook and Twitter and they say, I'm staying connected with people, I'm feeling like I have more contact with more people through these means, that kind of thing. And my wife, who just recently got on Facebook, finally after being beaten to death by her kids to do so, you know, said, I don't see that as relating at all. You know, just again, a completely different conceptualization about how humans can interact with one another. One group is very used to interacting through technology and does so without the blink of an eye and sees connectedness in that. The other group says, well, that's not face-to-face. That's not the same thing. Okay? It processes very, very differently. And I think, again, this is the sociology part of me coming out. I think we are slow to appreciate societally what that is doing to even the way we have our conversations about our society and the way we value what takes place in society. And that's why you're seeing some of the generational tensions and shifts that you're seeing because of the shifts in values, some of which is a product of how the different groups are processing the information that they're getting and the different ways they get access to that information. Yes?
You talked about the postmodernists having concerns about authority. Do you think a postmodernist would have not only a problem of authority as far as big government, but an authority as far as maybe the Bible, but also big business as well?
Doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what the authority is. As I said, it tends to be more localized in its concerns. And there tends to be a react. The interesting thing is that the one thing that I think has that postmodernism shares with modernism, as I suggested in the earlier question, is this reaction to the idea of authority, because it reacts to making judgments that suggest accountability and standards for people. I mean, it's just the warp and woof out of which it has come. So I don't. It doesn't matter whether you're in business, whether you're in theology, whether you're in government or politics. There's a skepticism towards it. Although I will say, with regard to government, there's an ambivalence, because what happens is that when there is abuse, and postmodernists ask, "How are we going to fix the abuses that we see?" They tend to be less optimistic about a local solution than they are a more comprehensive solution. And that then pushes you in the direction more of a big government approach to the question. But that's a rough generalization, and generalizations are dangerous. Okay, but I think if you ask me where the push is, when values collide and a decision has to be made, I mean, this abuse is just so bad to leave out there. Something's got to be done. They won't necessarily be hesitant to a corporate solution, a comprehensive corporate solution, if in their judgment it makes sense. I'm overwhelmed here. We'll go here and then there and then there. We'll just swing counterclockwise. Go ahead.
I think you mentioned that postmodernism entered the lexicon in 1979.
Right.
I was going to ask you, in terms of our understanding of postmodernism here in America, would you say that the events of the 60s caused it to ramp up more so than it would have otherwise?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not enough of a historian of the roots of the thing to necessarily comment. I mean, I do think the 60s were a very destabilizing kind of time for people. And, you know, I grew up in the 60s. But so it's possible. I mean, it came so late. I actually think that that part of what postmodernism wrestles with is this tension that I talked about earlier. As our world gets bigger, it gets smaller. Okay? So the next question becomes, how do we all get along? And so let me add something to it. How do we all get along when we're all so different? Okay? Now, you can either dig in, say, I got it right, and fight everybody else who's different around you, or you can try and figure out a way to work on that difference. And I think as the world has gotten more connected and more networked, if I can say it that way, the idea, it's easier for people to think through a variety of perspectives. Again, an illustration from using my kids and myself. When I went to school, the big deal, okay, was to have African Americans in the classroom. Okay, I'm talking about when I was in grade school and junior high and high school. I mean, civil rights was the big social issue. And the issue was, am I going to have an African American in classroom? By the time my kids went to school, they went to Hillcrest. By the time my kids went to school, okay, it wasn't an issue of an African American being in class. Hispanic, Indian, Chinese, Japanese. I mean, there were names, the African names, etc. I mean, an African American, you got to be kidding, is that all? Okay, now, that pictures, okay, the shift in reality. And rather than, another way some people have said it is, rather than having to go out to the world to see it, the world has come to us. Okay? And we now live in its midst. Okay? And whereas before, it was easier to shelter it out. I mean, you can drive by Highland Park and see the wall there. My kids joke about the wall on Northwest Highway. Okay? They see it as a metaphor. Or you can come to see, look, this is the reality my kids live in. They have grown up all their lives with not just an ethnically mixed classroom, with a nationality mixed classroom, which has caused them to see the world differently. Of course, it helped that we took them from the United States to Germany and put them in German schools for 2 years of their education, and so they were in one sense forced to experience another culture and experience American culture from the outside. That only highlighted the experience for them. But my kids instinctively are better at dealing with the multinational makeup of culture than I ever was prepared to be. Just by the nature of their natural experience. In terms of what they can express. Now, some people that frightens. Okay? But for other people, it's something to be appreciated and embraced.
Brief commercial announcement in response to the last question. We have a talk by Jim Filler from Eastfield College on historical roots of postmodernism coming up in May.
So I ask him that question. Hopefully he'll know what the 60s have to do with postmodernism. Okay, I said I was working this way, and I think I'm here.
You've come a long way in human history.
Right.
From ancient times to the medieval, the Renaissance, and today. From your point of view, what are some of the core values that have been discovered in the test of time? Which we can really say, this one really...
Well, I wonderful question. I still think there is great value in certain traditional values that predate modernism and postmodernism when it's applied. And I think things like the Golden Rule and the Great Commandment are very, very important. I mean, to me, I think it makes all the difference in the world. I'm going to offend, I may offend atheists in the room, but I don't mean to do that. Just try and hear me here. I think it's very important to appreciate that we are creatures. And that there's an accountability that extends beyond my own autonomous existence as a human being. And that accountability extends in two directions. It extends to Creator, okay, and I'll let you think about what that may or may not be. And it extends to fellow creatures. And this sacredness that I'm talking about, that I alluded to earlier, is a part of that. And I think when we lose that, our ability to abuse the relationships that we have potentially goes up exponentially. So if you're asking what the key core value is, I think we should never lose sight of the fact that we are creatures and that life is a gift. And when we start to move into entitlements, then it becomes my entitlements that become really important. And then you get into power.
It seems from what you said that overall postmodernism is not that friendly to theistic worldview. Now, I'm simply thinking that maybe you could look at the Bible and you can find some leeway for this type of thinking in Psalms and Proverbs, and Psalms more than you could the more objective statements that are historic.
You're asking a great perceptive question. Just keep going.
Well, that's... If you might comment on whether I may be seeing postmodernism through a conservative lens,
mm-hmm.
but from what you're saying, there's more things to back up agnosticism than there is to back up theism. So theism is almost a personification of absolute values in some way.
Yes, I think it's at its core level, because postmodernism doesn't believe in absolutes and dogma and propositions and those kinds of things, which is what I'm getting at when I start to talk about assessment. Okay, it can be viewed. Let's say it this way: it can be viewed as a less certainly a less theistic way of reading the world, or even a non-theistic way of reading the world. Fair enough. What I think postmodernism does for us, however, and I say this as a theologian who has a theistic worldview and who recognizes all that when I talk about postmodernism. What I think postmodernism does for us, however, is to challenge us as human beings to have a sense of humility about what any one of us is capable of understanding. Okay? Because of the angle of emphasis on perspectives and that kind of thing. Now, what I don't want to do is simply retreat and say there are a variety of perspectives out there and each one just adopts his own and we do the best we can, okay? Which is where a lot of people will end up, okay? So we acknowledge the diversity, we know it exists, and we accept it, and that's the end of it, okay? But we don't engage each other on that diversity, okay? What I want to do as a theist, and that's why I said this is a dialectic, It's not an autonomous lens. It's not something you embrace on its own at the expense of other ways of seeing. What I want to do as a theist is to come along and say, all right, now let's engage. Let's have conversations about those things that we see, even those differences that we have. Okay? And engage those. Okay? And that's the theist in me talking. Okay? Who says, if I stop with pure postmodernism, then when I come up to certain situations that even people instinctively sense are not morally neutral, okay, I begin to have a way of thinking about how can I address those and not simply say, well, that's a matter of perspective. I'll use an example. Someone's, a radical Islam. They have the right to their perspective and they have the right to live out their perspective. Whoever gets in the way, sorry for them. Okay? I want to be able to make an assessment about that kind of an approach to humanity. Okay? When I do that, I think I speak as a... I don't just speak as a theist, nor am I saying only theists can speak that way. Don't hear me saying that. But I'm speaking as a theist when I have that concern.
Okay, can we have one more question?
Sure. Oh, man. How many hands do I have?
Can I just make a real quick comment on what he said?
Yeah, sure.
The postmodern, to me, opens up the metaphorical thinking of it, which makes it a much more living interpretation as opposed to dogmatic. To me, that metaphorical is something that you can relate to as your own experience, and interpretive to your own experience. The dogmatic, frozen God sitting on a cloud is something it probably has a problem.
Yeah, I think that's fair, and that's actually what I've tried to emphasize in presenting it, is the more metaphorical variety of perspectives, that kind of thing, aspect of this, which I actually do think is healthy in helping us think through the diversity that we actually do live in. Okay, I think all that's very, very helpful, and that's why I'm trying to come to postmodernism and say, look, I'm not going to say this is all bad or all good. I'm not going to say it's all bad or all good because on one particular point that may be of personal interest to me because I'm a theist, it's an opponent. Okay. But what I want to try and sit back and say is, how do I assess what this is saying to human beings about the way they see and view life? And what I see is a mixed bag. And so I'm going to say, what I see is a mixed bag. and I'm going to try and be clear about how I think that bag is mixed and why. Okay,
Okay,
well,
good.
Okay.
One more.
Okay,
I didn't like rocket work.
Okay, all right. I'll come over here, because I think I said I'd go this way, and I think me and you are, and we have so few ladies in here,
okay.
You ought to be able to.
One thing that keeps making me jump is when you use the word instinct. Just two totally separate comments.
Okay.
And I think there's evidence that we are conditioning people to be this way. We're conditioning them to have this kind of process. So that we may even be changing people neurologically. So instinctive, I think, is a little, instinctive.
Let me comment, because I think your point's a fair one. I do think that there's an element of conditioning to it, but I also think, if I can say it this way, the conditioning gets to a point, and remember I'm making a comparison, okay? One group's been conditioned one way, if you want to think of it that way, the other group's been conditioned another way, and now we've been conditioned to the point where we, and this is how I was using the word instinctive, I think, we instinctively react to information in the distinct ways that we do.
Okay, we condition.
Exactly, right. Okay. But that, and whether it's conditioning or it ends up being instinctive, in the long run, I'll say it doesn't matter, in the sense that the reaction to information that results is different. Okay.
Now, my other sort of open question is what happens when postmodernism comes slamming up against pre-modernism, those societies and countries who haven't even reached enlightenment thinking, are contemporary with us.
And what you're seeing in our world is a lot of those collisions. As people move into countries and try and work with countries that are coming out, Madeleine Albright wrote a book, this was 4 or 5 years ago now, in which she said one of the dangers of raising people on such a secular model is that we are disqualifying them to react to much of the world which is theological. Okay? And she said it's really important that our diplomats understand religion and how it works and how it motivates people around the world. Okay, and if we don't teach our diplomats how to do that, we are sending them out unqualified. Okay, I think she's right. Okay, and I think she's very perceptive to have seen this, and that's part of the clash that you're seeing in a lot of these parts of the world, where something we do, I'm going to use the word instinctively, okay, where something we do instinctively isn't so instinctive to the persons that we're interacting with, and it produces all kinds of if not tension, misunderstanding, and miscommunication, even about its intention. But I think the point is a good one. Thank you all very much. Thank you.